Today I'm with Craig again from our investment partners, Evidence Based Investments, and today we're going to look at the sort of here and now, where insofar as many people are asking what they should do at the moment, should they be taking money out? There's so many things going on in the wider world. And the second thing we're going to be looking at is why for some time now we've been advocating that all clients should be moving to more of a global-based approach when investing. So two themes, but there's some commonality across both of those. But Craig, can I start by just asking Brexit? Who the hell knows? Could be Brexit in name only, could be no deal, the pound's wobbling, heightened uncertainty. I ought to just take all my money out and stick it in cash, shouldn't I?
I don't think I quite go along with that. Brexit, the UK represents about 6-7% of global market cap. And so speaking back to the original thing you said, Ray, are advocating using global, the impact on the UK will be an impact on 6% of a portfolio. So if you have a global portfolio, the Brexit thing becomes a bit of a non-starter. Because the any impact that is felt in the UK will have very little impact on a global portfolio, because whatever we're not selling Europe, somebody else in the world will be selling them instead, and we'll almost certainly own that in the portfolio. So yeah, Brexit just gets washed out as a bit of a non-event. But even in a UK-based portfolio, the truth of the matter is 80%, 70, 80% of the FTSE 100's revenues come in from overseas, so they're not UK-centric. And again, whether that'll have any real impact on UK markets on a lasting basis, it's certainly not enough to sink a portfolio out of sight like maybe we saw with the Japanese stock market 25 years ago. And you saw Trump with his taxing imports from China, etc. And we saw Harley Davidson, they just started making bikes in Europe instead. And so whilst there might be some short-term ructions with Brexit, with some companies, they'll find ways around it. They've got the capital, go and open a plant in Europe, or find other ways of getting their products delivered to them. So whilst I'm not a politician or economist, I really don't see this having a great long-term impact on the portfolios. And I really don't think you can look at anybody and say that individual knows for certain whether this will be as bad as it is being made out to be in the media. So, if you're global, it's almost going to be a non-event. If you've got a UK bias, it might have an impact, but I'm not so much that it's going to swallow up 10% of your portfolio in a week or two. I really don't see anything in the long run that's going to hurt us.
So, if we're talking about stock markets, that's fine in a sense. But what about even more concern about strength of the pound, weakening of the pound against other major currencies? And I guess if we were talking about being a bit more global based with clients, then there may be a little bit more, if you like, dollar domination. Should we be thinking, my God, is now not the time to be doing any of this, or should we be more worried about the currency issues?
Well, on the point of is now the time to do anything, I mean, that's a difference between investing and speculating. If you want to jump from a global to a UK portfolio, or from a sterling base to a yen-based portfolio, your market timing, you're saying, I know more about the way the market's going to go now than the market itself does, who as a body of investors across the globe has priced every piece of information into the current exchange rates. And we don't advocate that. I know you don't advocate that, because there's no therein lies a road to madness. The idea that you think you can market time. There's been more ups and downs this year than we've seen in a decade. And on each down, it's been the end. It's been the beginning of a market slide, and it's come back up again. And through all the gyrations this year, what we've seen is about a 1-2% drop in market values over the whole year. It's actually been not anywhere near as seismic as people are making it out to be. And as for currencies, well, they tend to. I'm not the chartered financial analyst of the company who could use all the correct terminology, but they pretty much washes itself out. If the dollar goes in one direction, equity is going another, because they're deemed to have a better or worse return because of the change in currencies. And we should, whilst currency will undoubtedly affect the nature of the returns that you're going to receive, you get you might have a slightly higher bit of volatility or lower because of the effect of currencies. When you look at the real dangers in portfolios, those really big market crashes, I mean, you know, the one that should be in most investors that we deal with, living memory, should be 73 to 75. And that was a 67% loss in on the FTSE All Share, 75% if you actually factor in inflation. And that had nothing to do with currency. You know, that was a market imploding on the spot that wrecked people's portfolios. And ironically, if you had a global portfolio then, you would have had nowhere near as deep a shock to your portfolio as you would have done if you had only a UK-based centric portfolio. So the problem of concentration risk in a certain economy or a certain currency, go and talk to the Japanese about that as well from the 80s and 90s, I can't remember what it was. The market fell away. I think it's still 50% of where it was. Those are actually greater long-term risks than having a better diversified portfolio, which, yes, may have a little bit more volatility, but it's marginal compared to the problems of concentration risk. Now, we deal with people in advisors in France, in Italy, in Ireland. I can tell you, nobody in Ireland wants an Irish portfolio. They want their bonds hedged back to euros, but they nevertheless want global exposure. I don't think you can look at dollar and say now's the time we should be investing or disinvesting because of where it is. You have no idea where it's going to be in the future. We may get one-to-one parity. We may be back to $2 to $1. You just don't know. But you're letting in a greater evil by trying to market time currencies.
So just for clarification purposes, can we just confirm for our mutual clients that what we're advocating is a non-hedged approach for equities, but a hedged approach for what we call the fixed interest, the bonds, the asset class that offset the risk of the equities. But can you just briefly confirm why we advocate or why we implement that approach, Craig?
Yeah, hedging equities is a little bit more expensive to do because you have to keep hedging during the course of the month as they move around. They move around quite a lot compared to bonds. And the cost of doing it and the risk that's brought to the portfolio through equities is greater volatility and greater risk in the volatility of equities than there is in the volatility of currencies. So you're paying for something that won't in and of itself get rid of the problem of volatility. Whereas with bonds, they have a very, very different role in the portfolio. They are the water to the whiskey. They are the shock absorber of the portfolio. So we don't want any form of volatility in the short or long term that may be delivered through exchange rates. When equities fall to the floor for whatever reason, we want a portfolio that hasn't had some degree of magnitude of loss driven into it because of exchange rates. We want that there to be more or less on parity to what it was the day before, and hopefully to maybe have some negative correlation because money's flowing out of equities into bonds, which we own, and therefore the price has gone up a bit. And that's the purpose of this. So you absolutely want to get rid of the currency risk in bonds, but in equities, it's just not worth the cost of doing it. We'd have a huge problem trying to do that anyway. More than half the funds we use are just not available in hedged versions. So you couldn't do it. And even if you did, you probably still wouldn't want to because the cost of doing so wouldn't get rid of the volatility of the currency. And it's just not a risk worth spending that amount of effort on getting rid of.
So similar theme, slightly different question. Hmm. We've been talking about clients getting a little bit twitchy and behavior-wise what they should do. Hypothetically, somebody's just extracted a whole bunch of money from their business or somebody's inherited funds or there's cash on the side, but I'm not going to invest it because now's a terrible time and I'll wait till it gets better. What are we going to say to them?
That's actually a self-defeating argument, isn't it? Because I'm going to wait till it gets better means I'm going to wait till the market's gone up, doesn't it? I mean, what other signals do we have that things are getting better other than the market going up? So what we're saying in that particular instance, in its purest sense, is I'm going to wait until we can buy in at a higher price. And, I'm going to advocate we lose a bit of money here. It's a very tricky question because the maths of this, if you take human emotion off the table, behavioral bias here, if you take that out of the equation, the mathematics is it's the earlier you invest on aggregate, the smarter it is, the greater the return. So if we had, you know, 20,000 days in history we could have invested on, the earlier date would, on average, be a better date. But of course, that's an average, which means there are some winners and some losers. But on aggregate, it's wiser to invest early. Now, the difficulty is that tomorrow the market goes down and I've just invested £1 million and I'm going, well, you know, why didn't I wait another day, Craig? And it's as if we can... It sounds like there's some mechanism that will give us a lead on an optimal time to invest, and there just isn't one. And the easier way to you know, view this problem is to expand the horizon of the time frame. If you go back to the concept of investing and speculating, if we're investing, we should have an investment horizon for most people of 10, 20, 30 years. I think most of the people we deal with are usually talking about, you know, this capital for the rest of their lives. In your particular analogy there, the example, the gentleman's retired, sold his business, got capital, so he's going to, you know, want to probably generate an income for the rest of his life on this. The horizon he's got to invest over is extremely long period. So whatever, when you look at investing today, tomorrow, in a week or two's time, where the price is up a bit or down a bit, it really doesn't make a lot of difference. If we can show him through the tools that we have that it almost didn't matter when he invested historically and he takes his income out, he would have enough money to the end. It's really not about whether that's the biggest pot he could possibly live when he dies or not. It's, have I got enough to sustain me through to the end? Because if you try and market time this, there is no wise way of doing it. You can feed it in over a period. That's an alternative, but it's still mathematically not the on aggregate the best way to do it, because you may be buying in at higher and higher and higher prices and you're doing better off doing it earlier on. But it's often a way to at least feel not so bad that you don't put it in on Monday and by Thursday the market's fallen 20%, which, you know, could happen in any day of any year. That risk is no more higher now, really, than it was back in October 1987, was it? 87. I mean, nobody knew a few days before that, Black Wednesday, I think it was, the market was about to fall to the floor. But whoever invested on Black Tuesday, or not quite so Black Tuesday, had to suffer that. But they went through it and out the other side. And 20 years on, it did make a great deal of difference. You know, all those future years of returns will add up. But it's a perennial problem that we all have as advisors, as trying to get around, you know, the twitchy client that says, oh, my friend on the pub told me to wait a week, and had I done so, it would have been the wise thing to do. It's impossible. You can't know what next week's prices are going to be. You should be getting it in earlier rather than later. But it's not always that easy. Clients are always not always that prepared to accept the ups and downs.
On a behavioural theme, I guess, I read an article last week that said one quick and easy way to reduce the volatility in your portfolio is to stop looking at it monthly and start looking at it 6-monthly. I think it was slightly tongue-in-cheek, but again, I suppose it does drive it that if you look at the thing so often, and I think, did we not say before, Warren Buffett often talks about, if you're a farmer, you don't look at the weather forecast every 25 minutes. So as you rightly say, it's trying to remove some of those short-term things, which we started off talking about with the you know, the Brexit side of things, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, none of this really works on aggregate for the invested public unless they have a longer term investment horizon, because as soon as you start to short and narrow things, I mean, you can talk about daily, monthly, but you know, with ETFs you can trade minute by minute. You know, day traders in and out, and all the evidence actually with day traders is they on aggregate don't beat the index that they're trading within. The other thing is actually women do better than men, I believe, because they're less aggressive on their trades. But yeah, you know, essentially what you said about Warren Buffett, because I wonder if farmers nowadays with apps do actually look at their weather every 25 minutes to see if they can quickly go out and mow the lawn before or till the field before the next cloud comes in. But yeah, there's an old adage, isn't there? There's an old story of a stockbroker showing his client the returns and on a chart, and the client's going, oh my God, what is that huge dip there in the middle? And they say, hang on a second, you just go to the back of the room and let me put this on a screen for you. And they say, what do you see now? So I just see a straight line. So that was the problem. You were just too close to the evidence. And it kind of speaks to what you're saying, is that if we shrink this, you end up with so much noise in the returns in which you're trying to turn that noise into a sound that makes sense. And it's just white noise. The ups and downs of daily activity, of pricing, of the world trying to work out pricing, of stocks based upon new data will drive you nuts. There was a study done on people who looked at their portfolios on a regular basis, and those that didn't look at their portfolios for longer periods of time, which, you know, I must admit takes quite a lot of faith in the people you're working with to, you know, not to scrutinize what your portfolio is doing. But those that generally didn't look at what the portfolios were doing had better returns, which doesn't seem to make any sense because they should all have got the same. But those that were looking on a regular basis felt they had to do something. It screams against all the math that me and you might understand about selling high and buying low, because people do the exact opposite. You know, they buy high and they sell low. Something's done badly. Oh, I need to get rid of that and buy something else. What am I going to buy? Something that looks good. Someone's got a good story. Well, in reality, what you're probably doing is you're buying something that's at the bottom end of its curve, and you're selling something that you're trying to buy high, and it's something that's already had the best of its days, and you're going to buy more of it. And that's what happens when you try and pay too much attention to the white noise in the short term. So yeah, we tend to, with our clients, not over embellish the performance part of the conversation, as if, you know, we need to take something from last year's performance and imply that that changes are necessary, because the evidence says absolutely not. Buy and hold. I bring everybody back to, you know, some of the very basic maths here. 90-odd%, 95% plus, even more if you have these factors to tilt. I think you get up to about 98% of what you're going to see by returns is your strategic asset allocation, your 60-40, 70-30, 80. Get that right. Well-diversified portfolio, super low cost, and you really don't need to look at the minute-by-minute data. And that's a common investment problem for an awful lot of clients.
I'm glad we got onto our mutually favourite topic of stockbrokers, because that sort of feeds into this business of global investing. And I think for many people, one of the initial perceptions would be, well, isn't that going to be mightily expensive if I want to suddenly start investing in lots of the great companies around the world? Isn't that going to be blindingly expensive? And why do I need to do that? Why can't I just cherry pick a few in the UK? So I think from the point of view of questions we often get asked about if we're advocating more of a global approach, some of the downsides, isn't that going to be blindingly more expensive?
Well, not blindingly. It's got a heck of a lot cheaper. So if we, when we go back to our original portfolio some 8-9 years ago, we were UK bias, and I would have been sat here advocating a UK bias portfolio. And really, because nobody bought global portfolios. And you know, part of my arguments were that it is more expensive to buy global stock than the UK, and that was really because if you look at, you know, a UK fund, you do all your trading on the FTSE All Share on the London Stock Exchange, whereas if you buy globally, you've got, I think it's something like 27, 28 developed markets, German Stock Exchange, the French Stock Exchange, US Stock Exchange. You got to trade in so many more exchanges. Emerging markets, I think, is another 27 exchanges. So you're up to 54 exchanges compared to one. But along came iShares and Vanguard, and their sheer scale is such that they're buying these things anyway. So as a fund, it's really almost immaterial whether it holds 30 stocks, 300 stocks, or 3,000 stocks, because iShares doesn't necessarily think about trading a stock for a given one of their funds. They effectively go to their pool every morning and say, all of our funds need to buy £37 million worth of BP today. In fact, they'll actually trade off internally. So if they've got to buy some BP and sell some BP, they'll just trade the difference. That's one of the advantages that Vanguard and iShares bring to the party, is these internal trade-offs they can do within the company before they go to market. So that it isn't more expensive per se to run these funds. Certainly not blindly. You're typically talking 5 to 10 basis points, which in the old days it was 50, 60 basis points. It was a lot more expensive, and that gap has narrowed and narrowed and narrowed to the point where it's such a negligible amount. I mean, emerging markets, you can buy emerging markets. We do buy emerging markets for 18 basis points, 0.18. And that's, it's almost no cost at all. I mean, it is a cost, but when you look at the old days, your average Management fee on a managed fund was 1.5%, and now you're buying emerging market stocks for 0.2. In America, you can get that down to, not 0.2, 0.18. In America, you can get that down to, I think, about 0.14 with Vanguard, just through the sheer scale of these funds. Tax was another actual issue of cost. Offshore, overseas companies, international companies usually had higher tax charges in their own countries before dividend distributions got paid across into other countries. That's pretty much all but disappeared. You do have to be careful about how you buy your product. Certain mutuals have higher tax drags offshore than they do via maybe their ETF equivalent. So, but we're onto that. We try and make sure we use the funds in our portfolios that don't have these slightly higher tax drags. But the tax drags more or less disappeared. Use the right funds. The costs have narrowed to a sort of vanishing point now, where most people will be paying about 10 basis points for a UK portfolio, UK only, whereas they can buy the whole world for less than 20 now. So it's certainly not it's not tripling expensive.
So if we're talking about a difference in diversification or the number of individual holdings in an overall portfolio, and we still unbelievably see investment portfolios where they've got a dozen or 15 UK shares and a couple of funds. Just give our listeners some indication as to kind of the overall level of individual holdings in a global portfolio. If it was just mixed 60% equities, 40% bonds, roughly what are we talking about in terms of individual equity holdings, individual bond holdings?
You have about 8,000 individual securities and about 11,000 bonds. But there's a couple of caveats to add to that. With bonds, for whatever reason, they count the number of actual bonds. But if you've got 20 bonds issued by one issuer, if that issuer fails, then pretty likely all 20 bonds that they've issued over a period of time are going to go down with it as well. So you want as many bonds as possible as you can in the portfolio to increase the number of issuers that you have in the portfolio. So you could have a very small portfolio with 50 bonds in it and have 50 unique issuers, or you could have one issuer and 50 different allocations at bond tranches of bonds that they've issued. But you do have about 20,000 securities, which probably makes our portfolios one of the most diversified portfolios that there is available to you. And as you say, there are any number of funds out there that have maybe only 20 or 30 stocks. So without you needing to ask me the question, I'll give you an answer to something you may ask me. Of course, if you've got a global portfolio, you're going to pick up pretty much all the tech companies out there, all the oil companies, the finance companies. You're going to get pretty much the market split of each one of these sectors, which you're not necessarily going to get with a UK bias portfolio. And that's one of the problems with UK bias portfolio is it's very, very light on IT companies. It's very heavy on finance companies, banks, a lot of banks, thanks to the City of London. And so you get a skewed performance. Now, maybe banks will do better than everybody else, but that's not the game we're playing. We want the return for capitalism with the added returns from these certain factors that we employ. But we want the return of the world, of capitalism, as the core of our holdings. And then you don't have to worry about BP blowing the top off an oil rig. Because if BP failed for whatever reason, we own all the other companies, oil companies in the world pretty much, and they'll pick up all the other oil rights. If you had three or four banks go down in the UK and the UK couldn't bail out, the UK government can bail out the banks again, people may go around the corner to foreign banks, which we may not have in our portfolio. So there is a sector risk that you run with a UK bias portfolio. It's just taken off the table as a risk with a global portfolio. So you're getting a benefit for no real cost by going global.
I'm glad you mentioned BP because that feeds into another classic question of, I like BP because they pay high dividends. Why would I have wanted to invest in Apple for 10 years when they never paid a dividend? If I invest globally, sorry, it's one question with about nine parts, Craig, but if I invest globally, I'm going to get less income. Shouldn't I be bothered by that?
No, you shouldn't. again, coming to the back to the simple maths of it, if you've got two companies with exactly the same balance sheets, exactly the same profit and loss, the same turnover, they're twin companies in two parallel universes, and at the end of a given year, one of them's got £1 million on its balance sheet surplus, and it decides to keep that on the balance sheet, and its twin brother in the alternative universe decides to dispute that as a dividend. I mean, the shareholders in each of these universes have got exactly the same return, because when you part with a very large slug of money off your balance sheet and distribute it to the shareholders, your share price will drop to reflect the fact that the company's not worth as much as it used to be because a big slug of cash is gone. And in the long run, you get the same return. But because we're not focused on this dividend yield, we have more companies in the portfolio, like Apple. And who the hell would not have wanted Apple in his portfolio over the last 20, 30 years? But simply because it didn't pay dividends up until recently, it would have been excluded. So there's a sort of a fixation on yield or income as if it's some kind of magical additional return. And it's not. If you have the cash and you don't distribute it, it's reflected in your share price. And because of the way that we're investing via unitized funds, we can strip out from the total return, be that capital, be that income, the return that we want. And your clients might want to ask you to have a look at the difference between the 7IM income portfolio and our portfolio 35. It's one of our sort of classic slides. Almost identical characteristics, except the return for the income fund is about half the return, I think, for our portfolio. And it's only because they're chasing yield at the same time as everybody else is chasing yield. So they've got the higher income, but the capital return is getting killed, because every time the income drops from one of these underlying assets, everybody starts to sell at the same time and the price goes down. So you're constantly chasing this high yield. Creeping up behind you is a poor capital return. Add the two together and you end up with an overall worse performance. So we would not advocate income. That's just it's old school thinking. It's culturally what people used to do, but it doesn't make any numerical sense.
So, in short, the intention to, or the advice to move people to more global-based approach has got absolutely nothing to do with any of the short-term economic, political events or whatever that we're seeing out there. This is a longer-term story, and it's not something we would then change depending on whether it's Brexit in name only, no deal or whatever. It's got nothing to do with any of those things at all.
No, absolutely not. Demand might have been driven by that, but it's worked out for the better, because it is making people do things that they should be doing, albeit many maybe for the wrong reason, but hopefully with guidance from ourselves and advisors of your caliber, we can put them straight and narrow. We're evidence-based, it's in our name, but the evidence for this is it doesn't need to come from the sages of finance. It's simple maths. The expected return of Germany, France, UK, any developed country is the same. You know, because if America's expected rate of return was 12%, the UK was 8, money would move into US stocks and buy them until the price changed, until they had the same expected return as the UK. That's not to say the US or the UK may have a higher return in the future. One of them certainly will, but we have no idea. But if we simply have, one-on-one investing, if you've got money and you want to buy one bank share, your risk is you can lose 100% of your capital if that company goes broke. Buy 10 banks with the same expected rate of return, on an aggregate, you get the same return. But of course, if any one of them fails, you only lose 10% of your equity. So, diversification is the free lunch of investing. That's not me. That's a Nobel laureate. And we go global. We just add in way more diversification. We get rid of sector biases that can creep into the portfolio. And so it's just an inherently lower risk portfolio, but it has the same expected rate of return. It's a better trade-off of risk and reward. And that's simply it. There is a cost, but the cost is absolutely minimal. And I think over time, that gap is narrowing to a vanishing point where we'll be buying global portfolios because of demand. The size of these things are getting bigger and bigger. That they'll be as cheap as a UK one. But it's not like we're paying 1% compared to 0.25%. We're paying 10 basis points instead of 5 or 15 instead of 10. It's minuscule.
Is there anything else you'd add to people who have reservations about, who might understand the story, but who then might introduce, again, some behavioral elements to this and say, I don't like Donald Trump's, American stock market is high, US dollar is strong, all the wrong signals, I'm not going to go global?
Well, I think if anything's told, history's told us that Donald Trump seems to have absolutely no influence on you know, he's been a terrible, well, most of us will probably agree he's a pretty incompetent individual and just stomps around, you know, bashing away at economic policy. And yet seems to have had, you know, a really good impact on the market. I don't think we can correlate his influence and market returns. I think probably most of the good work was done by Obama before him. But you don't know that the dollar's not going to get stronger going forward. And in terms of, to step back, going back to your behavioral finance, the thing that we probably most have to do with clients is to, it's like the addict, isn't he, or the alcoholic. The first thing he has to do is admit he's an alcoholic. And the first thing people need to do is, you know, recognize behavioral problems. And if you can get the picture that it really doesn't matter having a global pull, it doesn't matter that we go more Japan right now or more Europe, that you cannot knowingly influence the returns. All you will do is bring risk into the portfolio that you get it wrong and you lose capital value. Your chances of enhancing it are absolutely random. And in fact, your behavioral problems will probably make that worse because you'll double down on the risk if you make a bit of an error to try and make back the money you've lost. And all that just compounds into you know, more and more wealth destruction. I mean, I think generally speaking, most of us would agree that financial services has generally been a wealth destroying exercise for clients, not a wealth enhancing one, because we've pampered as an industry to the needs of clients who want to chop and change and move. I mean, the financial service industry got paid every time they did it. But the evidence is none of that works. So admit that we have these biases and try and get them into check. And you've really, really got to stop trying to think that there is some way that I know better than markets and prices in terms of whether Trump, it's all going to be a colossal mistake from here on. Tomorrow afternoon, he might end up phoning the Chinese prime minister or president or whatever he's called and end up playing golf with them and be best of pals. Market shoots the roof 20% a day and you're not in it. And that's the risk.
Is there anything else that we haven't covered that you think is relevant for, I guess, for the two things we've looked at today? So the sort of short-term uncertainty or the general recommendation to move to a more global-based approach. Is there anything we haven't covered that you think people should be aware of or perhaps better understand?
Yeah, well, the only thing I'd add is that what we're seeing at the moment is volatility. It's certainly not a market correction by any means. If you look at the... I think out of 11 months, we've had -7 and +4 so far this year. But actually, the return since January for our global and our UK portfolios are -1-2%. I think a lot of people just haven't seen negative returns in 10 years and think that's dire. But the truth of the matter is, it isn't Trump, or it isn't the Iranians, or it isn't the Chinese, or it isn't Putin, or the Greeks, Portuguese, or somebody else. I mean, if you go back to the last 10 years, this is normal behavior. I often say it's being a bit like snow in November. You don't get to see it very often, but you shouldn't think it's the global warming suddenly doesn't work. It's in the data, and it's perfectly normal to see snow every now and then. It's perfectly normal for these things to happen. And world economics in its normal state of play is not everybody's happy and everybody's making money. There's always trouble afoot, and it's somewhat... the media makes more out of it. If it bleeds, it leads, isn't it, that they say? And you've really got to turn that dial right down. These things will come and go. You own in a portfolio pretty much every string of capitalism that can be publicly available owned. So, yeah, maybe one facet will go down, but another facet of your portfolio will benefit from that. You know, if oil doesn't do well, it's because we're using other forms of energy. And guess what? We own those companies as well. So you really just stand back at the back of that room and look at the chart and see the general upward line over decades and buy into that story rather than the daily news and all the white noise that comes out of it. So we found over the years we get less and less of those kind of calls because people get used to the idea of the ups and downs are actually just business as usual.
Craig, this has been a brilliant half an hour, and it's I think it's a great reminder in two particular areas. But I think hopefully as well, It will, you know, this can act as a bit of a reference tool and information for people to refer back to. So I think a really excellent half an hour, some really excellent anecdotes and nuggets in there. So thank you, and no doubt we'll speak soon.
All right. Thank you, Duncan. Goodbye.